welcome to the KTEP Book Club on Perspectives. I'm your host, Louis Sines. And joining us today is Mary Helen Spett. She is the author of Migratory Animals. It's her debut novel, and it's been getting a lot of rave reviews. In fact, Ben Fountain, author of Billy Lynn's Long Halftime Walk, it's a great book as well. An ambitious, highly accomplished debut. Spett moves among a deep cast of characters and corresponding perspectives with absolute mastery. Most important and impressive is Spett's sure handling of the interior life. And you've got a lot of other rave reviews, but first of all, I'd like to thank you and welcome you to the show.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
So tell us a little bit. You're a fellow Texan, right?
Yes. I grew up in Abilene in West Texas.
Okay.
Well, we consider it West Texas, although in El Paso you might not.
Yeah, we're in the far West Texas. We're what Marty Robbins wrote about. And so anyway, tell us a little bit about your interest in writing. Have you always been interested in writing?
My parents are both librarians. So I was raised among books. And so I loved to read growing up. But really, when I was a kid, books made me want to kind of live inside of them rather than to write them. I wanted to be Meg Murray in A Wrinkle in Time. For example, I wanted to play with the Bunsen burners after school and save my father from the Tesseract. And it wasn't really until I was in college that I became kind of really intent on writing books myself rather than just being an avid reader.
Now, you mentioned about science and trying to save your father. This book, your protagonist, Flannery, is a scientist, correct?
Yes, she's a climate scientist.
The way it opens up, Flannery is in Nigeria, and then I don't want to give away the book, but kind of guide us through it.
Okay, so excellent. So overall, I'm exploring kind of the lives of a group of 30-something friends kind of struggling through the recession. And it begins with Flannery, who's the protagonist, and she's been living in Nigeria as a scientist and has fallen in love and feels like she's maybe found a home there. And at the beginning of the novel, she is forced to kind of return to the States for what's supposed to be a small amount of time. And she gets kind of re-embroiled with her old group of college friends that are each kind of encountering their own struggle. And doing the research on Flannery was really fascinating for me. I love the research part of writing. For me, it's the easiest way to really start to connect with my characters. I sometimes encounter the idea that writers are able to just kind of create and empathize with characters unlike themselves by just pure force of will. And while I think the desire to empathize with the experience of others is certainly a prerequisite for being a good writer, I think empathy comes more from being able to understand someone's situation, and I think that comes from real research. So I got to interview climate scientists. I got to learn a lot about snow. For some of my other characters, I got to do research in weaving, research in Huntington's disease. Yeah, so I love that. I love doing that. For me, I start with the concrete. What are the jobs my characters have? What are their daily lives like? And it's only after I spend a lot of time exploring kind of the outside world that I'm able to start to access their kind of inner world, if that makes sense.
Now, when you're doing research like this, a lot of people, even though it may be a fictional book or historical fiction, people look at this and say, wait a minute, she has this wrong or he has this wrong. And I know myself, being a former television journalist, when I watch movies and I see what they're doing, I go, wait a minute, that's not the way it's done. And I'm sure that you have to be very careful when you're doing that type of research and writing.
Yes. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. You can really break the kind of fictional illusion for your readers. They start noticing things like that. So I do. Not only do I do kind of research on the front end, I also often will have the people who have been, kind of willing to let me interview them and talk to them in these fields, often have them read those sections later to see if they think I got it right. Of course, there are some aspects of the novel that I do kind of play around with reality. For example, in the book, there's the university or the college where the friends all meet. It's based on Rice University, which is in Houston, but I moved it to Austin in my book. So I do kind of take some liberties like that in terms of the setting and some of the places that the characters visit. But in terms of the actual kind of jobs of the characters and what they're involved in, I really try to make that as accurate as possible.
Now, when you're writing something like this, and because of your background, especially having parents who are both librarians, is anything different that you do, especially from seeing and being around so many books? Do you try and pattern yourself after somebody, or do you see what they do and try not to do that? How does that work, Mary Helen?
Yeah, that's a good question. And actually, I certainly have some writers that I return to all the time just because of the beauty of their language, like Virginia Woolf, Michael Ndaji, Zora Neale Hurston. But based on working on a project, I find what I like to call mentor texts, and I also teach this to my students in my creative writing classes, finding texts that kind of speak to what I'm trying to do. So, for example, for this book, I was looking at many different points of view from a number of different characters, lots of different kind of back and forth between Africa and the U.S. And so I looked, for example, at Jennifer Egan's Visit from the Goon Squad. I looked at Colin McCann's book, Let the Great World Spin. I looked at Chimamanda Ngozi's Half Yellow Sun. And while I don't think that my novel really resembles closely any of those books, ultimately, I did kind of look to, like, how do they do it? What is their techniques for transitioning from different points of view, for example? I forget who said it, but there's, I think, the famous quote of good writers borrow and the best writers steal. And I definitely think that I don't obviously steal the words, but I steal a lot of the techniques.
It's interesting that you say that, because I know that I tell my students that you should write to express, not to impress. And sometimes, as you know, some of your students may do this where they write big words, big sentences to try and impress the professor, when if they just express themselves, it sounds a lot better. And you do that very well in your book.
Oh, well, thank you. And yeah, I absolutely agree. And one of the questions I try to get my students to start asking, like when, for example, like for workshopping fiction in classes, is what is this particular story by the student trying to be or trying to do? Because there isn't kind of like one standard or one way, you know, that we should all be writing. I think sometimes creative writing programs get a bad rap. There's a sense that we are, you know, that they're turning everybody into the same kind of writer. But I think the best type of creative writing programs ask, well, what is it that your gift is? What are you trying to say? And how can we help you do that?
We are visiting with Mary Helen Spett. Mary Helen is the author of Migratory Animals, the novel. And a little bit about Mary Helen. Her work has appeared in numerous publications, including the New York Times and Colorado Review. She is a winner of the Richard Yates Short Story Award, among other prizes. She is a former Fulbright Scholar to Nigeria and Adobe Paisano Writing Fellow. She earned an MFA in fiction from Emerson College and now teaches creative writing at St. Edward's University in Austin, Texas. So, as I mentioned, you are a fellow Texan, and we're glad that you're with us here today. One of the things that you write about in this novel, which is your debut novel, is there seems to be kind of a struggle, correct me if I'm wrong, as far as Flannery, a struggle between Nigeria, where she has spent a lot of time, or back home and her family, and she feels maybe like she's being pulled by both sides?
Yes, absolutely. And certainly some of that comes from my own experience. I spent most of my 20s kind of pinballing between a dozen different locations. And so when I came back to Texas and started to write this book, I was really thinking a lot about place. How do we find our home in the world, especially since we live in a time where most people do not die in the same place that they're born. You know, many people are forced to move because of jobs or immigration status or family. I think there's a much more difficult kind of struggle in contemporary America in terms of finding that home and feeling at home in that place. And so Flannery, she feels like in Nigeria, she has found a place that she belongs, but it's also complicated because she's, you know, a white Westerner who's able to kind of come and go, and she has these kind of family obligations that start kind of rearing their heads back at home. Her sister is starting to show symptoms of the genetic illness that killed their mother, and so she really feels torn between kind of where she feels at home in terms of pleasure and where she feels at home in terms of obligation. I think that's definitely something that I've gone through and experienced, and I think a lot of people I know in this day and age have as well.
It sounds a little bit, and I'm not in any way insinuating that you took that idea from that, because you mentioned everybody feels that way. But if I remember correctly, in The Bridges of Madison County, Francesca feels that way with Robert Kincaid. She wants to go with him, but at the same time, she feels those obligations that she has at home. And a lot of times, like Flannery in the book, her mother passed away. She's, in a way, trying to escape, stay busy, but at the same time, she knows she has these other obligations.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's actually kind of a really great parallel. And I feel like our lives are kind of built around the two things, being true to our own selves and our passions, but at the same time, being true to those around us. And for me, the book is, you know, it's about family to a certain extent with her sister, but it's also about her obligation to her friends. And I think that's something that interests me in part because I'm an only child. So I grew up, my friends are really important to me and kind of a part of my extended family in a way. And I feel like a lot of novels don't necessarily focus on the kind of the friendship relationship. But in my experience, those ties can be kind of equally complicated, especially as we change, as we grow older and become maybe slightly different people than we were when we first became friends. And so seeing how these lives kind of intertwine and affect each other over time is actually one of the reasons I moved to writing novels from short stories. I was kind of interested in exploring how those relationships change over a longer period of time and how people can kind of come apart and then come back together in interesting ways depending on what's happening in their lives.
We talked about this at the beginning, but what gave you the idea of writing migratory animals? Is it because of your travels and what you said earlier?
In part. I came back, and I actually was really lucky to get a writing fellowship right after I came back from Nigeria, where I got to spend some time on a kind of a defunct ranch by myself for 6 months, kind of processing my experience there and starting to write about it. And as I was kind of thinking about, you know, my personal interactions, my personal kind of struggles with place, I started thinking about a lot of what ifs. I wondered, you know, what kind of person would I have become had I stayed in Nigeria? And then those what ifs kind of cascaded. So then there was, what if there was an American scientist who felt she found love and a home in West Africa but wasn't, you know, able to stay? And what if that scientist had a sister? And so that's kind of where the germ of the novel began. And during this time, I was also kind of watching the recession, which is the book is set kind of during the recession, ravage people, many of whom, you know, were well-educated, ambitious, people who had expected adult lives, at least as successful as those of their parents. And I was particularly interested in the people I knew who were second-generation immigrants or first-generation college graduates and had been taught that, you know, graduating from a good school with a good education was kind of like all you needed to kind of propel yourself into the middle class. And the recession kind of highlighted how the system is still really rigged in favor of the privileged. So those are things that were kind of going on in my head as I was writing the book and kind of inspired several of the characters and their struggles. When I was just kind of randomly, I was actually listening to the radio, and I heard a really interesting piece on NPR by Charles Sabine, who's a former war correspondent, and his family has Huntington's disease, and he kind of was talking about his own decision to get tested, and I was really kind of moved by his story, and it started me thinking about how Huntington's disease, where you watch a parent, you know, kind of go through these horrific symptoms that you have a 50% chance of inheriting, how in a twisted and really magnified way, that's kind of like what most of us go through on some level in terms of watching our parents age and knowing that in a way we're kind of watching some permutation of our future selves. So that's the way the Huntington's became kind of part of the book.
We are visiting with Mary Helen Spett. She is the author of Migratory Animals. It's her debut novel, and it's a great novel, and it's available on the internet, as you know, that most books are available. But we're continuing our discussion about the book and a little bit about her background. When you talked about interviewing immigrants, first-generation college people, did you find that perhaps in your writing, people who may not be familiar with Texas or the Southwest or West Texas, they're starting to see, well, wait a minute, is this the way it really is? Because a lot of people, especially back east in New York or in Washington, don't understand the border or Texas and what goes on here.
Yeah, and actually that makes me think of, I think it was several decades ago, but Larry McMurtry's kind of famous salvo in which he said that, you know, Texas writers paid too much attention to nature and not enough to human nature, and why are there still cows to be milked in every Texas book? And which, of course, somewhat ironic is coming from the author of Lonesome Dove, but I really think that I consider myself to be more in the lineage of writers like Sandra Cisneros or Steve Harrigan, Oscar Casares, Brett Anthony Johnston, that are trying to kind of explore the Texas is kind of beyond those cliches that people back east often think of when they think of Texas. Instead, like the urban Texas, the Texas of the Valley, the experience, I think, for 90% of people who live in the state these days, it's not living on a ranch, you know, raising cattle anymore. It's trying to survive these really kind of complex political and economic situations, usually in an urban environment.
Tell me a little bit about the gentleman that you met at the canteen. I'm not sure how you pronounce his name.
Oh, Coonlid, who Flannery meets.
Yeah. Okay, yes. So I'm sorry, I'm talking about you. Yes, that's how involved I am in this story here. But when Flannery meets that person, tell us a little bit about what happens, because you write about a lot of different feelings and vibes that they get when they're first when they see each other and then when they're sitting across each other. If you wouldn't mind sharing that with our listeners.
Yes, she has just arrived in Nigeria. It's supposed to be a pretty short climate research stay. And she kind of meets him at a canteen outside of the university. And he suggests that she orders the palm wine, which is this kind of white, sweet liquid that's tapped from the palm trees in Nigeria. And they strike up a conversation, and he ends up giving her books to read. He also loves books. And it's kind of like the beginning of their love story, which kind of continues throughout the book, both in present tense as well as in flashbacks that go back and forth to Nigeria. And it was really important to me to not portray Nigeria or Nigerians one-dimensionally. Kind of like how we were talking about how people in the Northeast have an idea of Texas. I think a lot of Americans and people in the West have a pretty simple idea of what life is like in Africa. And I really wanted to show that while there's certainly, you know, rural huts and villages without running water, there's also kind of gleaming modern houses and concrete flyovers and people, you know, with graduate degrees talking about books. And so Kunle kind of represents that generation that has kind of grown up in this school system in a much more contemporary cosmopolitan Nigeria. And so they actually have a lot more in common than one might think. Of course, you know, as the novel goes on, there's also the conflict that emerges, a Flannery, you know, like a lot of white people that have gone to Africa, having this sense of wanting to help kind of save them. And that kind of creates a bit of a conflict later on between Flannery and Kunle.
You're absolutely right. A lot of people have the misconception when they think of Africa, they think of the bush, they think of the Congo, they think of the lions and Tarzan and and just like us, sometimes we think of New York as that big city and where there's a lot of crime, etc. And
sure.
And then again, people look at our border and say, well, that's where the drug cartels have all that violence. But when a writer like you knows the area, does the research and puts it on paper, sometimes it's easier to get that across through a novel than through a news conference or something on TV.
Absolutely. I mean, and that, you know, I think when a book is in a novel or fiction or stories are working like they're supposed to, they let us see the world in a fuller sense of complexity. And the Nigerian writer Chimamanda Adichie actually has a wonderful TED Talk called The Danger of the Single Story. And she talks about how there's really nothing wrong with a lot of the portrayals of Nigeria or Africa. It's only dangerous when they're the only voice that's being heard. And so, you know, as fiction writers, I think part of what can be really amazing with this job is getting to kind of express our experience in its kind of full, rounded sense for the reader, instead of those kind of quick news bites that you might get, those headlines in the newspaper that tell often a really kind of one-dimensional story. Fiction can hopefully make us empathize with people and feel like we understand their experience and are not standing outside watching their experience, if that makes sense.
We're visiting with Mary Helen Speth. She is the author of the book Migratory Animals, and we're discussing the novel as well as some of her background and her writing experience and her history, and she's currently a creative writing instructor at St. Edward's in Austin. Perspectives will continue right after this.
This Week in This American Life, Adriana was in Chicago, and she kept running into these homeless guys on the street, drug addicts from Puerto Rico. But why? And then one told her
that the municipal government in Puerto Rico had bought a one-way ticket for him to come to Chicago.
Wait, the government itself?
Yeah.
The government saying, not it. This Week.
This American Life, Sunday afternoon at 5 on KTEP.
We're visiting with Mary Helen Speth. She is the author of the book Migratory Animals, and we're discussing the novel as well as some of her background and her writing experience and her history, and she's currently a creative writing instructor at St. Edward's in Austin. Explain, if you will, to me, Mary Helen, when you said that the first draft of your novel actually had a 10-point of view characters, and now there's only 4.
Yeah, so I began writing the book. You know, I think, as I mentioned earlier, I kind of moved to the novel form because I really wanted to explore in this kind of larger tableau, multiple characters over a longer period of time. But I had written short stories for 10 or 12 years before kind of attempting this. And so my first few drafts were very much like a series of short stories rather than a novel with a more sustained arc. And so initially, my vision was all of these different characters and their stories coming together. And so I had 10 different point of view characters. Each of their chapters was almost kind of its own story. And over time, as I started to learn how to write in this kind of more sustained framework, I cut some characters all together, some characters got combined, and other characters just kind of are still here in the story, but they don't have a point of view like they used to. And I realized that I needed to kind of focus, at least in terms of my talent, some writers could probably pull that off, but for me, I needed to focus on the stories that were most kind of moving to me, that I felt like I could capture most fully, rather than trying to do smaller pieces of more stories. So I tried to go in a little bit deeper.
Tell us a little bit about, because this is your debut novel, the fact that a lot of authors, and I'm not sure how they do it, you know, there's pressure for them to do a sequel or to do something else, or sometimes they get caught in a rut or in a niche where, you know, Louis L'Amour wrote more than just Western stories, but that's what he was known for. So what kind of pressure does this put you in with your debut novel, or does it?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I think it might be a little bit too early to tell. I feel in some ways really lucky that I got an editor at HarperCollins who I love and who has been very supportive in terms of my voice, in terms of what I want the book to be, rather than trying to kind of push the book into certain categories. I have a lot of friends, especially like women writers, that often feel, for example, that they're being kind of pigeonholed into chick lit. Their, you know, books end up with pink covers with, you know, half a woman's face, and they don't feel like that really represents what they're doing. I feel really lucky that my editor and the people who worked with me at HarperCollins have been really supportive and kind of asking me. And maybe part of that is because I'm a debut and I'm a risk to begin with, and so they don't have as much to lose at this point, and it might be different with my next book. But I actually feel really lucky that I've been allowed to kind of push the book in the direction that I want. And I've already kind of started on my next novel, and I'm hoping to do something that centers on just one character this time and kind of look at it in terms of their larger life. So I'm excited to kind of go in that direction and see what happens. If I do end up getting pigeonholed in terms of the media, I'll have to kind of cross that bridge, I guess, when I come to it. But so far, I feel pretty free to write where the inspiration takes me.
You mentioned that a lot of women are pigeonholed, and it's interesting because a lot of the thriller mystery books are written by women, Lisa Gardner, Sandra Brown, Tammy Hogue. But at the same time, there are a lot of things that people want to read about. Now, you'd mentioned earlier about writing short stories and short, you didn't know which way to go. Are you still writing short stories?
I did. After I kind of finished this book and I was going through the editing process, I did kind of return and to short stories for a little while. And so I'm hoping to kind of finish up some of those this year. There's just kind of certain topics that kind of will spark within me that kind of seem to be asking for that kind of treatment. But generally, once I'm in the thick of the novel, I find it hard to write other things. Almost like anything I observe or notice or think about and write down ends up kind of falling into the novel rather than becoming its own story. And that's just, I guess, my personal process. But I also think what you were saying about the genre shift is also something I think is really interesting I wanted to mention.
Uh-huh.
I do feel like, at least I feel like hopeful, that literary fiction is becoming a lot more open to writers that are using different genre techniques. One of the National Book Award finalists this last fall was an apocalyptic book.
Oh, yes. Uh-huh.
And, you know, there's, you know, Jonathan Lethem and some of these other writers that have gotten a lot of kind of literary cred, but are able to kind of bring in things that they learned from writing mysteries or writing fantasy and science fiction. And so I kind of hope some of those borders are continuing to be kind of broken down little by little.
And even the example of Andy Weir and The Martian, that apparently he sold in chapters to some company, and then all of a sudden they decided, yeah, this is good. And so now it's a best-selling novel. I'm interested in, this is 6 years ago, though, so in reviewing the list of short stories that you've written, this is one that you wrote for the Texas Observer, Border Teens. I'm kind of interested in, the title really stands out.
Well, that is actually, when I was looking at, I was kind of reviewing books for them and looking at some of the books coming out of the Valley, and that's something that I really, is important to me. I feel like one of the things that we talk about, how there's often certain kinds of people that tend to get a voice, that tend to get published and promoted. And I think while as writers, we can only kind of write, you know, where our hearts lead us. We can't necessarily write what we don't feel. But I do feel like we can help promote other voices that are maybe kind of underrepresented. And so one of the things I really try to do when I'm reviewing books, when I'm teaching my classes, when I'm doing other kinds of promotion, is to really put writers in front of audiences that they might not have. You know, I can't necessarily write their stories, but I can try to make those voices heard. And so that's something I think that more writers and writing teachers kind of should be aware of, that sense of, are you doing your part to help the kind of diversity in publishing? We can't control which books Random House buys, but we can control which books we review and which books we assign to our students.
Well, Mary Helen, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us here today. Thank you so much for being with us. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you. I loved it.
We've been visiting with Mary Helen Spett, and she is the author of Migratory Animals. And you can Google it. Just type in Migratory Animals or her name. It's Mary Helen, Spect.
This is In Focus. I'm Mike Cuthbert. House sharing. It's not just cash-strapped college students running a place together. Older single women are pooling their financial resources as well. In the U.S., more than 4 million women, age 50 and over, share a house with another female, and that number is climbing. According to the National Center for Family and Marriage Research, 1 in 3 female baby boomers will probably face old age without a spouse. How well can these situations work out? Primetime Focus host Aileen Ellis visited with 3 ladies who lived together as good friends for over 4 decades.
I'm Nancy Fassett, originally from Minneapolis.
I'm Margaret Sugg from North Carolina originally.
I'm Barbara Fletcher. I've been in Washington for 50 years, and I still sound like I'm from Durham, North Carolina.
Barbara is the spring chicken, age 75. Nancy, 83. Margaret, 85. They moved in together almost 50 years ago in 1972. They're in their light-filled living room, furnished with antiques.
I don't think that would happen again in a million years, that 3 grown women could live together and not kill each other, be happy. We all like to travel, go to the beach in the summer, the same types of furniture. We don't argue about what we buy, usually, entertainment. We just like the same things, and we like each other.
It all started when Margaret and Nancy met at a group house where they were living. Margaret, a staff director for a congressman, hired Barbara. The 3 became fast friends, and soon they were chafing to buy a house together. They wanted enough space for individual privacy, a pool, and a wet bar.
We figured one of us would get married, one of us would get another job. We'd end up going our separate ways, but we'd go with money rather than nothing. But we had such a good time together, we just kept going. We usually have cocktail hour between 6 and 7. We have a good time just sitting around talking about what's happened during the day, movies we want to see, books we've read. Nancy is a big opera buff. I'm more interested, I think, in pop music than the other 2 gals are.
Margaret is an artist. She painted one of the 2 homes the trio has built. It's a spectacular place in North Carolina, and the painting is really inviting. All this, of course, takes a lot of financial resources, and not every lady's salary is the same. So they plan their expenses based on what the person with the lowest salary can easily afford.
We have a household account. Every month we contribute the amount necessary to pay our bills for the month. When we needed a furnace, for example, we would all just pony up a third of the cost of the new furnace. So it's always been on equal footing and a third share for each.
One lady's a teacher, another a librarian, and the third a real estate agent. And eventually, they all retired. Back home, yard work was tough, so Barbara and Margaret wanted to buy into a retirement community. Their big house at Asbury Methodist Village has 3 dens. The monthly fee is affordable. Each lady can pay it alone when it's time to move into assisted living nearby.
We'll be cared for. This situation here allows for the possibility. But so far, I'm knocking on wood, we've been fine. We've been able to stay together.
And we have so much fun. Now everybody calls us the Golden Girls.
The Golden Girls. It's even inscribed on white napkins on their wet bar, celebrating their friendship.
My heart breaks for people who are by themselves, because I'm sure it must be very lonesome and frightening. And that's one of the great blessings of our relationship, that we've got each other to fall back on if we have problems or needs. It's an amazing relationship for us.
This has been In Focus, made possible by AARP, and today, Aileen Ellis. To hear more stories and postscripts, please visit aarp.org/radio.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineers, Norma Martinez, DJ Orozco, and Belinda Fernandez. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.